Welcome to our evening talk. Today I wanted to talk about the interplay between religion as a social phenomenon and religion as a seclusive phenomenon. This is actually what I was asked to talk about on Friday when I went to this Indian religions class. And it got me thinking. We tend to think of Buddhism as a seclusive religion, even a reclusive religion. With the idea that it's something that should be practiced alone for yourself. Because in Buddhism we tend to privilege ultimate reality or phenomenological reality, an experiential reality, a sort of positivism it's called, which says that it's your senses that act as the primary source of wisdom and understanding. And so all this has very much to do with your own experience, it has to do with your own being. It doesn't have to do with relationships and societies, constructs, concepts. But I think it's important that we don't ignore the world of concepts. If you look in conventional society, the interplay between seclusion and socialization or socializing society You can appreciate the benefit of these two aspects of life. I mean, much has been, I think, said directly and indirectly, descriptions of the results of socialization and the effects of seclusion. And so I think we can categorize Buddhist practice into one or another of these categories. They don't all fit entirely into the seclusionary or seclusive aspect, the seclusive side. Obviously, concepts like charity, humility, love, compassion, all the Brahmaviharas. They certainly have our society plays a part in these, our relationships with others. And in general, this is what is, I think, said about society, is that there are certain qualities that are cultivated through our relationships. Love, appreciation, humility. We see this, I think, most in terms of xenophobia and bigotry and militarism. Sometimes simple communication, interaction, socialization, it leads children to be more understanding, more accepting, more compassionate. There's a certain form of wisdom that comes from having to deal with other people. There's certainly a certain amount of purity that comes, a certain amount of purification that can be done through overcoming our social anxieties and overcoming our fear of fear of committing social, what do you call social, I don't know what the word is, committing social errors, social mistakes. Fear of losing face, they would say in Asia. Learning how to communicate. Learning empathy, sympathy, compassion. There are certain qualities that I think come from and having people criticize you, having people challenge you, even compete with you. Well, compete maybe not in a Buddhist sense, but challenge you certainly. Argue with you, debate with you, call you out, remind you, encourage you, right? So the Buddha said, association with the wise is the whole of the holy life. And not whole, H-O-L-E, it's not the whole. It's the whole, it's the entirety of the holy life. Probably better to say it that way. So it certainly isn't simply about secluding yourself. It's about surrounding yourself with good people for a reason. Many of the commentaries will talk about how you cultivate good qualities. Again and again, one of the reoccurring pieces of advice is to associate with people who have these good qualities. Associate people with people that have good behavior. Associate with people who are interested in spirituality, holiness, purity, wisdom, etc. Associate yourself with enlightened beings. Because their society, if you associate with them, things get better, not worse. And so a corollary of this is that concepts are not to be shunned. And the interesting thing, thinking about it, is ultimate reality, sankharas, ultimate reality insofar as that part of reality that arises and ceases is equally useless, equally meaningless, maybe not useless, but equally meaningless. We don't focus on ultimate reality because it's preferable. It's no better than concepts. In fact, concepts are, for the most part, preferable. Why? Because concepts can be anything you want them to be. You can build up all sorts of wonderful concepts. Like when you're in love with someone, you build up this concept of who they are. And it pleases you, that concept, much more than ultimate reality ever could. When you think of the house that you live in, you buy this nice house or you buy this nice car. The concept is just a wonderful thing, much more than ultimate reality ever could be. The problem with concepts, of course, is that they don't actually exist. They don't conform to experience. So your concept of what someone is like is quite often shattered. This is what leads to problems in relationships when people act in ways that you weren't expecting. Ways that are not comfortable, that are not appealing, that don't conform to your expectations, your image of who they are. So the preference for ultimate reality is because of what seclusion gives you, because of what experience or experiential reality gives to you. And so this is sort of the tendency that we find even outside of Buddhism, what we get from secluding ourselves, from looking inside. This is what gives us philosophy. It's what gives us a lot of religion. Let's see, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad. That's in the Abrahamic religions. And we got Buddha going off into the forest. We've got, I think Mahavira as well went off to the forest. Lao Tzu went off into the forest. When we look at in the Enlightenment, we have Descartes as my sort of my favorite in this sense, that he spent some time alone thinking about these things. But all the philosophers, I suppose, if you observe their habits, they would spend much time alone contemplating. This is where philosophy comes from. I was homeschooled through public school, and I remember it being a terribly lonely experience. And I think my social skills are stunted as a result, but boy, the philosophy that came out of that period. It's probably why philosophers are often tortured, because of their lack of social skills. So it's interesting to look at the interplay between these two aspects, and I don't think it serves us to be completely focused, as I often am in my talks, on the seclusive aspects. I think we could argue that they're to be favored. Seclusion seems to be clearly more important. So I don't think you could argue that society is something to be focused on, and the Buddha was highly critical of people who cling to society. I think there's a higher gain ultimately to be had from seclusion. So society has gain, there's benefits to it, and it's specific benefits that are useful. But ultimately philosophy and religion, both good and bad, come from seclusion. Seclusion which deals much more with ultimate reality, deals with who you are, deals with your own mind. So it's in seclusion that we much more develop as individuals. Because when we're secluded, then we're much more honest with ourselves. We're much more in touch with ourselves. We're no longer cultivating an image of who we are. Instead, we're watching and looking and seeing not so much who we are, but looking at what happens. Looking and seeing what happens from moment to moment. This is the kind of thing that you can't see, you can't develop easily, or you can't develop at all through relationships. This doesn't come from talking it out. If you have a problem with someone, there's some good to be had from conversing and apologizing and all that, but this doesn't change the underlying reality of our propensity to get angry and to fight, to be arrogant and conceited, and greedy and clingy, ignorant. All of that has to be done away with through experience, through experiential reality. And you can feel the difference, right, when you're living in concepts. Another thing that sparked this was this idea of second life. I talk about this often, and I get criticism for teaching in second life. I bet a lot of people are just shaking their heads at the idea. I got an email that asked, you know, why isn't it contrary to your teachings on understanding reality? Right here we have all these fake images of ourselves. But see, the funny thing is, this is no less real than the images in so-called reality. When I look in this room and I see the two people sitting on mats in front of me, it's no more real than than all these people sitting on the mats in Second Life. I mean, there are ways in which it's associated with more types of ultimate realities, but it's still not ultimate reality. Like, I can't reach out and touch all of you, and I can't. There's no sound coming from the pixels on my screen, but it's still all conceptual. Well, even when you're walking around, living your life, we're still living in concepts. If you look and you see someone walking down the street towards you, you're still not living in the present moment. You're still not living in reality. But then this shift comes, and this is what you should feel. This is the opening the door of insight. Opening the door to meditation. When instead of seeing the person, you realize that there's an experience of seeing. So the person sort of fades away in your mind, and instead, oh, I'm seeing. And instead of thinking about where you're walking or where you're going, suddenly you're feeling yourself walking, feeling yourself standing, feeling yourself sitting. This is what mindfulness is meant to do, what sati is meant to do. It's meant to remind you, to bring the mind back to this paradigm, this way of looking at the world, not in terms of concepts, but in terms of reality. There's so many good things that come. That's the first one is that it brings you to reality. The second one is that it straightens your mind out in regards to reality. It reminds you this is this, that is that, it is what it is, not more, not less, not good, not bad, not me, not mine. Not stable, not satisfying, not controllable, just is. Oh, and now it's gone. It is and then it isn't. And third, it teaches you about these things. It helps you see that you're clinging. You see the nature of things, some good, some bad. Useful, useless, beneficial, harmful. Because you've straightened your mind out, you're looking clearly at things. You're able to see, no, these things are impermanent, they're unsatisfying, they're uncontrollable. I'm clinging to things that can't bring me happiness. And so on. We go through these stages and this transformative process. It's the Buddhist rite of passage, insight meditation. I smile because I have a test tomorrow on rites of passage. Part of the test is going to be on the pilgrimage as a rite of passage and qualities of rites of passage. There's the isolation. The first stage is you or seclusion. No, I'm probably going to fail. Seclusion, I think. No, separation. You separate yourself from ordinary society and ordinary social norms. The second stage is transition, this liminal state where you're neither here nor there, you're in between. And it's marked by a sort of communitas, which is a state of communal intense immediate bonding among ritual participants is the textbook definition, but you enter into a new community, a community of travelers, in our case a community of meditators. And finally you have this integration where you go back into society with a changed outlook on society, and also people look at you differently. I mean, this is give or take, but in some cultures, having done a rite of passage, they look at you quite differently, like a coming of age ceremony or a marriage or something. So our rite of passage is an insight meditation course. This is the coming of age or the transition to adulthood. Anyway, so there you go. There's the Dhamma for tonight. I've been fiddling with this software, trying to get the... I'm really trying to get the video working again, but... it's messed up. So I know there's quite a few questions on our meditation site. Probably I should answer them at some point. You can go, I ask you not to stay for this part. Do you think you would have been interested in meditation or Buddhism as a teenager had you been to public school and associated with non-Buddhist kids on a daily basis? Why do you want me to speculate about my childhood? I think it's a bit too speculative. I understand that you have some... I understand what you're... the idea behind what you're asking is, but I think it's a little too speculative. I'm not sure what the variables would be for someone being interested in Buddhism having gone to... I can understand that there might be an argument for society being a distraction. And yes, seclusion being a catalyst for philosophical thought. So certainly there were factors there, but how great the factors are, I mean, there's a lot about past life and inclination. I was probably more into killing things as a result of being, I went hunting with my father and killed animals and was very sort of into nature. But that was also where we lived. We lived in the forest. Okay, I'm going to go through some of these online questions. Okay, here. Can someone who's done the online course schedule a meeting once in a few months to get further feedback? Yes, absolutely. Sure, why not? Here, I'm supposed to do this, right? Yes, sure. Should I meditate in the dark or shaded areas or stay in a lighter spot? Doesn't really matter. Have you read my booklet? Please read my booklet. If you haven't read the booklet, that's what you should do first. When you're saying that all life is useless, I understand in a broader sense. So what would be determined as useful? You see life as precious yet useless. How is this not a paradox? I don't see life as precious. I think someone was saying that human life is precious, life as a human being, but all that means is that a human life is more useful for you to get out of samsara. You might say it's like being in a burning building. What is the best place in the burning building? Well, that which is closest to the door. Oh, so you're saying, well, that part of the building is good, you should stay there. No, that's not what I'm saying. That part of the building is still bad. It's just better by virtue of being closer to the door. So a human life is precious in the sense that it's probably easier to be to attain Nibbana there than as, say, an animal. Now, I think the jury's out on whether being an angel is easier or harder, but I'm certainly not inclined to say that being a human being makes it easier to become enlightened. I'm not convinced of that. Life is not precious in any intrinsic sense. Can letting go of clinging make you look like a psychopath to others? Yeah, I suppose so, to some degree. I mean, I'm not really interested in answering this question. But I get the idea is that you're concerned, probably too concerned about people's opinion of you, right? They have to be careful. Don't get caught up in what other people think of you. But ultimately, very much no. I mean, enlightened being is the most peaceful being. A psychopath is someone who disregards reality, basically. You know, someone not wanting you to do something and you totally disregard that. In fact, the thing they learned about, if you study psychopathy, it's sociopathy or, you know, either or, they actually do have emotions. They just are very good at suppressing them, or they're suppressed, or they're dampened. They still do get angry and they still do have greed. It's just their emotions are not as strong, are not as strongly expressed. But they still have a sense of cruelty when they hurt others. Any suggestions on a monastic monastery to practice in? Ready to proceed? No, I can't give suggestions like that. That's too complicated. I mean, I don't even know where you live. Been practicing martial arts most of my life. Come to realize that the level of aggression and paranoia deeply unskillful. Additionally, some people outlook on violence. Is there any redemption to be found in these practices, such as pragmatics of self-defense? Well, I used to do karate for many years, never took it too seriously. Looking back, I was really kind of lazy about it, but I almost got to the black belt, but I think they just gave it to me because I stuck around so long. I wasn't really that good at it. But I think there are spiritual aspects to it in the sense that it helps you get in touch with your body and condition your body, you know, learn how to train your body, learn how the body works. So, I mean, I wouldn't recommend it, but I can see how it would, in many ways. I mean, for me, it was actually a catalyst to meditation because our teacher at one point, one day, had us do meditation, and then later when I was teaching the class, sometimes I would teach meditation. I think it gives people confidence. I taught it at high school after a while, just informally. We had a karate club at high school, and I think it gave some of the younger women more confidence. I don't know. I'm kind of speculative. I'm not all that interested. People tend to put a lot of importance on sexuality, saying it's fundamental, saying it's dirty and pure. I should treat sexuality merely as a strong itch. Well, you should treat it as a craving. Sexuality is desire and the objects of desire. See it as reality. I mean, it is. There is desire that arises and ceases. There are experiences of seeing and feeling and so on that arise and cease. If a thought, emotion, sensation, whatever arises, like lust, my mind instantly reacts by telling myself, no, don't do things. Even though I'm not meaning to. This causes me worry that I'm suppressing the feelings. What do I do? Do I just notice that it's happening and move on? Yeah, I mean, there's layers to our neuroses, I guess you would say. There's first the layer of our desire, lust, as you say. And then the next layer is, well, it's not layers so much. You don't think of this as suppression. This is an important distinction. We talk a lot about suppression, and it's not proper. Suppression, because in Buddhism there's not things on top of each other, there's things after each other. It's patterns of behavior that get very complicated. So I talk about layers, and that's probably a poor choice of words. It can be useful to think of that conceptually, but it's not really true. There's layers. I said it again. There's sequences of habits and complexity. So you see your habit, your tendency to react in a similar way, your pattern of behavior. And so it's really just a matter of breaking the pattern apart and into its constituent parts and noting each part individually. So when you dislike the fact that you want something, you say disliking or angry. If you are upset at yourself, upset, worried. When you're worried, you'd say worried. You can see this pattern of behavior. But it's not actually layers, it's sequence. And so there's no real suppression. There's not in that sense. There's a reaction, and the reaction creates results. Condition called aphantasia. Someone was also unable to have mental sounds. Would this person be unable to note and therefore unable to be mindful? Why do you give me such questions? If you're such a person, come see me. Is samsara truly the problem? Or is the mental distortions that cause us to be affected and averse to suffering there? Samsara is really the problem, yes. It's the problem. But the cause of the problem is the distortions, the desires, the clinging. It depends what you mean by problem. Samsara is the problem because it's suffering. It's a cause. It's suffering. But craving is the problem because it causes the suffering. Our mental image is rupa. Does it really matter? Mental images are, I think you would say they're, I'm not sure, doesn't matter. Is meditating and meditating, what are these questions? Jeez, I'm not that impressed by all these questions, tell you the truth. You guys are getting speculative on me. Is meditation in computer terms like emptying the recycling bin? I feel a lot lighter. I haven't been meditating in weeks due to school exams. Just today I started again and I can notice the difference. Yeah, sure. Meditation is like cleaning your house. It's more like cleaning your house. It's like untying knots. It's like meditation is retraining habits. It's maybe better not to oversimplify it, because then you get conceptual. That's to be clear about what's actually happening. But, you know, the idea of cleaning the recycling bin is on the right track anyway. How can the arahant know that parinibbana will be eternal? Maybe they will fall away from it and come back to samsara. It's not about falling away. It would be about something coming that has no cause. Ignorance can only arise out of a cause. Craving can only arise out of a cause. When those causes cease, they can't arise again. Is simply noting the frequent dislike towards the meditation enough to weaken it until the mental habit is gone? Well, it's not about weakening it so much. Yeah, I mean, you have to understand the important step there, that it doesn't just weaken it, it helps you understand it. And so that's what weakens it, and that's what changes it, so you're less inclined towards it. Do you have a preference for a few long sessions or several numerous short sessions? Do you believe the latter is more ideal for a beginner to the practice to undertake? I think there's a balance that has to be struck. If you do too long, too few, then there's lots of time in between. If you do too many, too short, then there's not enough time to build habits, to cultivate good habits, to get a good sense of meditation. So it's really about changing postures, because suppose you were to practice 24 hours a day with no break, would it be better to switch every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes? What would be the optimum? We put the optimum at about an hour, switching 1 hour, walking for 1 hour, sitting for 1 hour, and that is fairly standard. It's kind of arbitrary, but an hour is about good for an advanced meditator, you know, if they were to do back-to-back. And it's not normally recommended to do back-to-back for anyone, but, you know, for an advanced meditator, even on break, you're still mindful. So it's more about changing postures in that case, because it's not about the sessions, it's about being mindful. But if you're switching your postures too often, there's a benefit to staying in the same posture for a while, I guess. Another question pertinent to metta: what indication does natural loving kindness subsequent to the practice, as vipassana, have? Is this indicative of greater wisdom or disillusionment? Well, both, really. I mean, not disillusionment, but detachment, because you're less concerned about your own desires. So, but that's because of wisdom, because you've fewer needs and clingings of your own, you can be friendly towards it, but more friendly towards other. An enlightened being, a liberated being, has no needs of their own, and so they're able to be helpful to others. Are muscles sentient beings given their lack of brain and apparent central nervous system? See, sentience it's an iffy thing, you know. You have to understand, from a Buddhist perspective, it's not the brain that causes sentience. The brain attracts sentience. And the body, the fetus, the sexual act, I guess, attracts the person to be born. To some extent, we're just attracted to sex. So beings that reproduce sexually might be a good indication that the mind would be involved in an individual in a certain state of mind would be attracted to the sexual act on any level, even among muscles. And so there would potentially be, I don't know the answer to this, but there would potentially be a mind there. And using that as a guide, you might want to speculate that would be a reason for discounting the fact that the idea that bacteria have minds, because there's no attraction for the being. But that's really just speculation. I don't know that beings are attracted only to sexual reproduction over asexual reproduction. I don't know whether bacteria have sentience associated with them, but you have to remember that the being isn't sentient. Like, the body isn't a sentient thing. Muscles aren't sentient, but the question is whether there's a mind that's concerned about that body and is going to respond with displeasure and suffering as a result of a mind that is clinging to the body in the state that it is, and that it's disturbed by the by the change caused by death and physical pain. But you know, there's no good it's not a good argument to say that they're an excellent source of proteins and minerals with negligible environmental impact. I mean, that's not a good reason to risk, you know, to say, you know, it would be good if we, it would be good if they weren't alive, because that would be a good source of protein for us. You know, if there's any chance that they might be alive, then you should do your best to avoid killing them, you know? So that the problem comes with things like bacteria. You have to ask yourself whether they're really alive. One monk told me, yes, they are, but you can't see them. And because you can't see them, you're not really involved. You can't really be involved in killing them. And then there's the question of when you use antibacterial products. But it's like, yeah, anyway. It's a very technical argument, so I'm not really interested, but I would stay away from mussels, yeah. I mean, I would stay away from killing them. I guess you eat them raw, right? Which would just be awful if they're still alive. I live a lifestyle in which I have to avoid stimulation. How shall I phrase it that my mind is quite bored? Shall noting boredom and other subsequent mind states prove useful? Overcoming them and driving contentment. Yes, that's what I teach. You have stated numerously that anapana is samatha, and that seems to be how it is categorized within the Visuddhimagga as a kamatana. This may be true because it cultivates access, concentration, but not momentary concentration. Is that why it's considered samatha? It has been stated numerously that the Buddha used anapana sutta to gain enlightenment, even though he said it doesn't lead to insight. And even the four tetrads of anapanasati correspond with the four foundations of mindfulness. People as well say that anapanasati is the heart of the satipatthana, and so how could it not lead to insight? Anapanasati can be vipassana, it can be samatha, but anapanasati is mindfulness of the breath. Now, the breath is just a concept, it doesn't actually exist. That's why it's called samatha. So, if you're focusing on breath going in and going out, it's not going to lead to insight. Not directly, but if you switch and focus on the feelings, which we do by focusing on the stomach, then it's vipassana. It was never stated that the Buddha used anapanasati to gain enlightenment. This is an interesting argument. If you read what the Burmese Sayadaws have to say about that, this, they denounce it categorically. He practiced samatha in the first two watches of the night. In the third watch, he used paticchasamuppada. So he must have switched his practice because he was no longer practicing anapanasati. Anapanasati is what he used in the first two watches of the night, and it gave him pubeniwasanusati and chutupada jnanas, which are samatha jnanas. They're knowledges that come from samatha. But then he switched and he focused on dukkha, he focused on the five aggregates, which would be the four satipatthana. And saying that anapanasati is the heart of the satipatthana, well, in the Satipatthana Sutta, it's clearly focused on the samatha parts. Now, there are places where the Buddha says, anicca anupassi viharati. No, anicca anupassi passasamiti sikati, or something like that. I will breathe in seeing impermanence, right? But if you want to focus on impermanence, you have to focus on the ultimate reality, and it's no longer the breath, because breath going in and going out is not what you experience. You experience sensations. Now, a lot of people inadvertently focus on sensations and not the actual breath. But anapanasati, in terms of mindfulness of breathing, is actually only in, when you say in and out and you follow the breath, that's samatha. Or when you count 1, 2, 3, you use the breath to count 1, 2, 3, and so on. That's conceptual. That's actually being mindful of breaths. But anything else is vipassana, and it's actually called dhatu kamatana. If you read the Visuddhimagga, it makes this clear that dhatu vivattana kamatana is the true, is the only one of the 40 that links to vipassana. And maybe that's not true. It's the one of the 40 that is used, recommended, or as a description of the beginnings of insight when you focus on the four elements, because that's body, and body is the base of satipatthana. There, I answered all the questions. Perhaps not entirely satisfactorily, but the queue is cleared. Any more questions? All right then. Have a good night, everyone.